I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE, after the Biden administration was forced to make a deal to free the world's greatest journalist, Julian Assange, just before a televised debate with Donald Trump. It was Assange who released the cable from now CIA Director Bill Burns, telling the US government that NATO expansion into Ukraine would foment war. In the past few days, Russia has vowed to respond to the US-targeted killing of children on a Russian beach, as Biden appears to declare all but a full-on war on Russia's civilians. Viewers of Going Underground can watch our interviews with Julian Assange on Rumble, where he outlined election interference by the Democratic Party in the USA, let alone corruption at Google and the lies told to get the USA into forever wars. Today is also 10 years since a group calling itself ISIS, linked to Al-Qaeda, declared a state in Syria and Iraq. And it was Julian Assange who exposed Biden's now national security adviser, Jake Sullivan, telling Hillary Clinton that Al-Qaeda was on the side of the USA. Appointed by President Trump to the US National Security Council, now led by Sullivan, is today's guest. Brian Kavanaugh was also a top Biden official at Homeland Security, and he's now Senior Vice President at American Global Strategies and a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Brian, thanks so much for coming on the show in such a more dangerous world, would you say, than when you were in the National Security Council under Trump and for a short time under Biden?
Well, thank you so much for having me on today, Ashton. And I would have to agree that the world we live in today is fundamentally different from a security posture than it was 3.5 years ago. The world we live in today is there's stability is a thing of the past. We have conflicts raging in two regions of the world, and China is really ramping up efforts to destabilize the Southeast Asia Pacific region.
Well, we'll have to ask Xi Jinping on to contradict you on that one. You know, in this region, making a respite from what's happening in Gaza and Jerusalem. I mean, even the local paper here in Dubai, Assange to be freed man after 14 years, the Japanese Financial Times, pictures of Julian Assange. We've interviewed him on this program. I mean, do you think it's interesting that when Trump was asked, the subject of lawfare of his own, arguably, he said, yeah, he's considering a pardon if he was elected president. And then suddenly we have Biden reaching, the Justice Department of Biden reaching a deal. What do you make of Assange's release?
Well, that is certainly a case that was long overdue for some closure. As you mentioned, 14 years, and that dragged on through the legal system. From where I'm sitting, I don't want to speculate into how different political parties are going to opine on what to do next. At the heart of the matter, though, is how do we protect the U.S. operations? And at the end of the day, the United States has to conduct various operations all around the globe to protect its own national security. And part of that requires some information being compartmented and classified and kept private.
Brian, I know all that, but I tell you, I mean, I interviewed him and he clearly, Julian Assange, exposed how the U.S. Democratic Party, with Hillary Clinton there in the election with Trump that time, was trying to manipulate the election, was trying to destroy Bernie Sanders. There were resignations at the DNC after the WikiLeaks cables. You were at Homeland Security. What election interference risks were you noticing as regards what Hillary Clinton was up to? What there were officials in the DNC. And of course, since then, we've seen your former boss Donald Trump dragged through courts. The whole world is looking on and wondering what sort of democracy do you even have in your country?
It's a fair point. And during my 3 years at the National Security Council, when I led election security, the focus for the National Security Council, which is governed by the 1947 National Security Act, is foreign interference and foreign influence and operations from overseas. So the work is heavily focused on cyber, misinformation from overseas. And there's a group within the Department of Justice that handles the domestic civil disruptions and misinformation into campaigns. Certainly, it's interesting the information that was shared and put light through Julian Assange's efforts, and not to discredit the exposing those nefarious behaviors. The crux of the issue on the espionage charge was getting really after the threat it put under U.S. military troops and U.S. national security interests. But again, we are supposed to be a shining city on that hill for the rest of the world when it comes to our democracy. In the last several years, that reputation has been tarnished by some of the just divisive behavior and some of the antics that are being pulled into play in the political sphere here in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump famously said, "We love WikiLeaks," because it appears that he hadn't got that information of how Clinton had been trying to manipulate things in that election. But let's move on then to the foreign threats. Today is this anniversary of this group, ISIS, Daesh. And Jake Sullivan, who I understand you did have contact with when you were at the National Security Council for a short while. Thanks to Julian Assange, we have the email sent by Jake Sullivan, then to the then Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, saying Al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria. That's what we have, thanks to WikiLeaks. Did you know about that on the National Security Council? Did Jake Sullivan tell you about how the United States was on the side of Al-Qaeda in Syria?
No, and in my work, it was strictly focused on homeland security, critical infrastructure security, cyber. My interactions with Jake Sullivan were supporting that role of the National Security Council. Looking at foreign relationships, foreign affairs fell to senior directors that were in those that oversaw those geographic regions.
But what possibly could have been the reason, and Trump has alluded to it in campaign speeches, that the military industrial complex of the Democrat regimes under Obama could have been on the side of Al-Qaeda?
It's hard for me to speculate. I don't have all the information in front of me. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of when you have these personal correspondence back and forth between secretaries of state and the teams that they rely on to build their information space to make decisions. It's really hard for me to speculate not having that information in front of me and not being a part of those conversations at the time.
But do you think when Trump gets in November, the new National Security Council will be looking at all the documents and the documentation a little bit closer than Trump's first term?
Well, I would have to tell you, one of the most important things is Donald Trump's foreign policy has been pretty straightforward, and it's been actually very beneficial for the entire globe. Donald Trump has peace through strength, something that Ronald Reagan originally coined, but it was something that he truly embraced in his own style and put his own accent on that type of policy. And during those 4 years, the United States didn't enter any new wars. We didn't take people based on information through secondhand sources or through the misguidings of politicians. President Trump assessed every relationship as on the merits it stood on. And that was not just for our allies and partners, but he also revisited how we looked at various adversaries. It was actually quite refreshing.
Except for the killing of Soleimani, arguably. But yeah, what you just said there echoed what Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg and Fred Flights, I suppose colleagues of yours on the National Security Council at that time, said, quoting Hadrian, Emperor Hadrian. Well, Trump has been very clear that the Ukraine conflict wouldn't have happened on his watch. Another WikiLeaks document I've got here from he's now head of the CIA, but he was, of course, ambassador to Moscow, Bill Burns, saying, warning of the way U.S. policy could kick off a conflict in Ukraine and that Russia would have to move in because of NATO expansionism. What went wrong? Why did the Biden, Blinken, Sullivan, why has that administration been so wrong in, as opposed to what you were just saying about not starting new conflicts, creating new conflicts, arguably?
I think the track record speaks for itself. They've got a couple of years where every opportunity they've had to demonstrate strength in foreign policy stage, they've instead demonstrated confusion, weakness, or even a desire to pacify and succumb to the pressures of more tactics. If you look at the Afghanistan withdrawal and how chaotic that was and what that did with leaving tens of millions of dollars in military equipment behind for an adversary to take over, if you're Vladimir Putin, you're sitting there looking at that and going, this is not a government that's going to be able to stop me from rolling into Ukraine and doing what I need to do to restore my regime and restore my reputation. So again, if you look at all the
actions, you see it as that. You don't see it.
Scale really tips.
So you don't see it as the Biden administration provoking, and we know the Maidan coup of 2014. You see the withdrawal from Afghanistan connected to an imperialist Russia. So that doesn't really open the way to detente, arguably.
No, I would. You're slightly mischaracterizing how I would probably assess what I'm trying to get at. One of the things that former ambassador and former national security advisor Robert O'Brien would start every Monday senior director's meeting with was to remind us that weakness is provocative. And I would articulate that the weakness demonstrated by the Biden administration on a foreign stage has been provocative, provocative to Vladimir Putin, provocative to the Iranian regime. And now you're seeing how Xi Jinping and China is also using this weakness to flex his muscles and see how far he can push, whether it's the Philippines, Taiwan, and now with an air defense invasion or where they've an incursion into the air defense identification zone within South Korea just this past week.
Yeah, everyone laughed at Donald Trump when he very soon after becoming president, saw the dangers of North Korea in a way that previous presidents just hadn't seemed to realize. Now, under Biden, you have a situation where, and I've got to say, far from weakness, he poured billions of dollars of U.S. weapons into Zelensky's hands. But now, of course, Russia is all with a complete alliance with North Korea. How do you think a new government, a new administration in Washington should deal with that alliance?
Well, a new government coming into Washington, D.C. is going to have to deal with a power vacuum that was not there 4 years ago. And what do I mean by a power vacuum? The absence of having a unified front that's pulling together for the collective good and creating stability through strength. Instead, you have a new axis forming where you have Russia, North Korea, China, and Iran are starting to coalesce around these relationships that certainly are starting to mirror historical trends that were quite worrisome in the past century. So I think you're going to have to come into the next administration with eyes wide open and the challenges that are in front of you. And you're going to have to take some immediate steps to kind of reassert the U.S. strength in a way that does not tip the scales to a conflict. It can't be a reckless flexing of strength. It has to be very carefully crafted and done in a way that signals the message that we're not looking for conflict, but we are looking to stabilize a lot of the unrest that's occurring around the globe.
Brian Kamner, I'll stop you there. More from the former special assistant to President Trump after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the former special assistant to President Trump and current visiting fellow for cybersecurity, intelligence, and homeland security at the Heritage Foundation, Brian Kavanaugh. Brian, in end of part one, you were talking about the importance of not wanting conflict. Of course, that's the kind of thing Antony Blinken says when he's on these whistle-stop tours everywhere. Is that just talk then? Because he certainly seems to be flying around the world a lot, saying he's for peace, just the way Trump says he's for peace, but then conflict emerges wherever he goes.
Well, I don't disagree that his end goal is peace. I would argue that the ideology and the actions they're taking to achieve that peace are not working. And we've seen that for 3.5 years, that their approach to foreign affairs have been struggling and have opened the door to conflict. And frankly, you're looking at, relationships on fray. And one of the things that I recall was that when Joe Biden won the election in 2020, the assessment being made by many policymakers from that administration are, it'll be great to have the adults back in the room. Well, if these were the adults back in the room, it's the last 3.5 years have been really troublesome. Again, I don't disagree that he was striving for peace. The tools they're using, the approach they're making are not lending themselves to that peace.
Of course, Blinken has been clearer than any other Secretary of State, arguably, that, say, the proxy war in Ukraine is good for the U.S. military-industrial complex, good for factories, good for jobs in the United States. You never normally hear foreign policy being used as an economic stimulus back at home, conveyed in that kind of way to the American people. Did that surprise you? And does it work to say we're going to continue the war, continue having no negotiations and pouring money to Zelensky because it's good for the defense sector?
That's a terrible approach and not the way you want to bring back economic stability. If you look at historically over time, some of the best growth this country's had has come during peacetime. Unfortunately, the pandemic did set the stage for a lot of challenges, not just here in the United States, but globally. And when you're looking at what your Secretary of State should be saying, you shouldn't see the Secretary of State linking global conflict to a success on the domestic defense industrial base. It seems a bit misguided, a bit out of place. When in fact, what you should be looking for is healthy investment during peacetime and ensuring that you have the tools that provide strength will keep that peace. And that doesn't require you to rapidly ramp up the defense industrial base or spend down a defense industrial base. The other thing that's interesting is they're saying that at a time when, if you're comparing defense industrial spending or defense spending as a whole against the GDP, we are almost at less than 3%. And that is the lowest historically we've been since pre-Reagan.
But then what goes through your head when you hear that? I think Jake Sullivan said similar things, that somehow this is a great way of helping the economy. I'm not sure how many Ukrainians, any of the hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians who've been killed, think that your politicians in the United States are talking about it as it's a great way of helping the economy.
A great way of helping the economy would be to create more jobs and to find ways to put Americans to work here in America. I think there's a need to, globally, there's a need to diversify supply chains. I think you're seeing countries starting to do that. This neoliberalism or this new globalism idea that we took hold in the early 1990s to today, or I guess arguably through 2017, has shown weaknesses where we've centralized too many things. We've put too many items that cannot fail into one region of the world or one country. And then you're either usurping a power through malign influence, or you're running the risk that natural hazards or geopolitical contests can disrupt the flow of the supply chain for the entire globe. So, one of the things, whether it's the United States or other countries, should all be looking at how they can diversify and have a matrix supply chain. Semiconductors are a great example of this. I think it's irresponsible to have one company be responsible for 90% of the advanced semiconductors. I think for a healthy market, you would need to have several players in that space, and that will keep costs down and innovation high as there's competition. And then you step back and look at how we conduct modern warfare. What you're seeing today is what's happening in Ukraine with the use of drones. We're using very low-cost weapons platforms with very high efficacy and capabilities.
Yeah, but you know how much money the arms businesses give to your politicians as regards big capital expenditure items. What do you think some of these companies are going to think, let alone the semiconductors, the Silicon Valley companies, are going to think of the kinds of policies being flagged up that might happen in a Trump administration and how they would impact them? I mean, obviously, monopolies don't like stopping being monopolies.
No, well, I will tell you this. Actually, what I'm hearing as I speak with different individuals is a reassurance that they're not going to get something that's, I'll put this in the context of 2015, 2016, there was a tremendous amount of angst and anxiety, fear about what type of policies a Trump administration would bring into play. And what you saw after 4 years, you discredit the year on COVID. If you look at 2017 through 2019, it was 3 years of economic growth, job growth at record pace. You're looking at some of the strongest earnings in the commercial sector. I think what you have now are a lot of companies that want to see that brought back. Of course, it means we want to have matrixed supply chains. Of course, it means we want to have diversified markets. That's not a negative, net negative thing. And in fact, in the tech companies, you look at what's happening right now, I would imagine they're going to argue that the FTC under the Biden administration has been targeting them in ways that are even expanding beyond the scope of our borders, where the United States Federal Trade Commission is going into Europe and helping Europe fight antitrust cases against U.S. tech companies. I mean, that's unheard of.
How does that make any sense in terms of national economic security? Anyway, that's a whole program on its own. You're cutting out a little.
That's a great question.
I think Silicon Valley is obviously hitting this conversation because you're cutting out a touch there. What about then the fact that Biden says the U.S. military can target Russia directly, the weapons that he's sending to Zelensky? Do you think, I mean, some might say, and there's increasing worries about a much bigger conflict before November. What do you see behind that strategy in terms of your national security? Sensible for Biden to continuously change the red lines and allow the weapons to, well, according to the Russians, the attack of missiles that hit the beaches of Crimea, killing children, were targeted by U.S. soldiers?
So I don't have any insight into who is targeting. I would tell you that the United States has been providing weapons to Ukraine. Ukraine's picking the targets. Ukraine's choosing to conduct the military operations. It's choosing.
But they said they need U.S. soldiers themselves to do the actual targeting in situ. They're trainers, in effect.
To use weapon systems, there's obviously a training, and there is a need for U.S. soldiers to train them on how to use the weapons. But in terms of pulling the trigger, pointing the weapon, aiming the weapon, I can't speak intelligently because I'm not on the ground as to what's happening there. But I would tell you it would be a deviation from U.S. policy if in fact that was happening.
Then you wake up there at the Heritage Foundation and you open the newspaper and you see that there are Russian warships 90 miles south of Florida. I mean, tell me what you thought of that, given your long career in Homeland Security and on national security, on cyber threats, on so many different threats to the homeland.
When you step back and look at what's happening, we're in a little bit of an interesting dance between Russia and the United States on flexing muscles and who's going to back down first. I recently had an article published on the Cuban Crisis 2.0. And what we're looking at here is Russia's willingness to bring limited nuclear warfare to the United States doorstep. This has not been done since 1961, 62. And if I look at the United States, are we prepared for that type of engagement? I don't think that we have the civil preparedness or the mindset today that we had in the 60s in terms of how to confront that. I think that's an area of growth for the Department of Homeland Security to step up and kind of revisit what it means to have civil preparedness and not just all the climate initiatives that are currently being pushed in this current administration. When you step back and look at the willingness of Russia to put out a nuclear submarine with nuclear capabilities 60 miles off the shore of the United States and off the coast of Florida, you look at a open border that has let 10 million plus unaccounted for undocumented illegal immigrants into the country. And this is on the backdrop of ISIS resurging into Russia. We had in March an attack that killed 143 at a concert hall. This past week, we had 20 killed in what appears to be attacks on churches and synagogues in southwestern Russia. When you look at these things and couple that with how wide open our border is, you have to think to yourself, who is allowing this to happen? And right now, that's President Biden's policies on the southwest border have left the door wide open. His foreign affairs policy has allowed Russia to come right up to our coast with a nuclear submarine. And again, it goes back to this weakness is provocative. And that's what you're seeing. And so you had the FBI arrest 8 individuals across the country that were supposedly plotting for an attack that had not only come into the country illegally at the southwest border, but were at some point in time, contact was made by DHS and they allowed these individuals to continue into the country. This is it's not a broken law. It's a lack of enforcement of law on the books. And that's something that doesn't take an act of Congress, that takes the executive branch to actually execute the laws that are on the books.
Again, we had a former chief of staff at the State Department under Obama on this show saying that Victoria Nuland was fired for being something to do with the attack on the concert hall in Moscow. But you've written about LNC. Let's just finally talk about, you just mentioned, just what exactly, you mentioned limited nuclear conflict. What exactly is it? And you've just written about it, I notice. And do you think you're maybe someone who will be your counterpart? In a, who knows? Jake Sullivan, do you think he understands what LNC is?
I think there's a strong understanding of what limited nuclear conflict is. When you look at it, the nuclear arsenal for Russia has not maintained itself as a strategic deterrent. They have a strategic deterrent. It is not what it was several decades ago. Instead, what they've done is refined their weapons in some capacity and some percentage to be low yield or ultra low yield nuclear weapons. And what does that mean? Well, instead of having these nuclear missiles that eliminate entire cities off the face of the map, they have nuclear weapons that can take off city blocks and take off targeted infrastructure. So if you're trying to disrupt the United States and you want to take out the energy grid, you can use a limited nuclear conflict to target a specific power generating facility. You can use it to target specific communications hubs that you need to, if you want to take down communications networks. And these are the threats we're facing today. And what happens is we've built up defenses in the United States to handle strategic intercontinental ballistic missiles. But what we don't have is the ability to detect, manage, and mitigate these low, ultra-low yield bombs that are coming in that could be deployed by an individual who is crossing the border illegally. We call them dirty bombs a few years ago, but the accurate phrase is LNC, or limited nuclear conflict. Russia has an enormous stockpile of tactical nuclear weapons, and those are anything from rocket-propelled to small missiles capable of being fired from close proximity.
Brian Kavanagh, thank you.
Thank you, Sheen. It's been a pleasure on the show today.
Well, that's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by UK-US-EU armed genocide in this region. We'll be back on Monday with the president of Rethinking Foreign Policy and former US director of Israeli NGO B'Tselem, Mitchell Plitnick. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.